This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 6 of Here's How. On this show, you'll hear the SIMI talking about congestion charging, Catherine Murphy talking about SiteServe, Julian Despoin talking about Irish language education, and there's lots more.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
There's a story of a Fianna Fáil politician, not long retired, from when he was a newly in the Dáil. The Department of Posts and Telegraphs had a 7-year waiting list if you wanted to get a telephone. In case you don't remember, up to 1983, the Department of Posts and Telegraphs, the P&T, were responsible for the telephone system. They had a legally enforced monopoly. No other supplier was allowed. Prices were high, especially for international calls, but just getting the telephone in the first place was a struggle. Most of the questions in the Dáil to the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs asked when would such and such a constituent get their telephone. They applied years ago, their grandmother is getting on, they might need it to call a doctor for her. There were literally thousands of these questions. Civil servants would be sent off to find out where the constituent was in the queue. The answer would be typed up and the minister would stand up in the Dáil and answer the TD's question. And the TD would write to the constituent and tell them how many more years they had to wait. A large portion of the staff of the department was devoted to handling queries from the TDs. Our cute Fianna Fáiler had an in with the staff at the local branch of the P&T. When it came to the time for a constituent to get their phone, the P&T staff would bring the telephone not to the customer's house, but to the TD's office. The TD would then drive to the customer's house, followed by the P&T van, and with a big smile, the TD would present the telephone to his constituent and say, "There you go now, Mrs. Murphy, didn't I tell you I'd get you the telephone in the end, and haven't I the fella to put in the wire for it here and all?" Right now, we have two big problems with nationalised companies. The first problem is homeowners with variable rate mortgages being soaked on interest rates. These mortgages basically allow the bank to set any interest rate they like. In the past, that didn't really present a problem because the competition for new borrowers kept the rates down, and if things got really bad, borrowers could move their mortgage to another lender. That isn't happening now because, for the most part, the banks want to deleverage. That means have less borrowing on their books. So they're happy to lose the mortgage holders. And even if there was competition for the business, many of the borrowers couldn't move anyway because they're in negative equity. That means that, although ECB rates are at historically low levels, 0.15%, that's a little over 1/7 of 1%, even though the rates are so low, mortgage holders are paying up to 30 times that, increasing the bank's profits. Our banking system is so broken that customers have little choice except to pay or lose their house. The government could do something about it. It owns all the banks, in part or whole. So it could order them to reduce rates, or it could bring in a law to force them to do so. But the government also needs to get money by selling those banks, in the hope of getting back some fraction of the money that was poured into the bottomless pit that was the banking bailout. If they force down bank profits, they will also push down the price that they will get for those banks when they're eventually sold. The government is in a bind. Should it be businesslike, trying to get the best price for its assets? Or should it use its muscle to ease the pressure on mortgage holders? And if they do try to ease the pressure on mortgage holders, isn't that just buying votes with taxpayer funds? These type of contradictions don't lead to good business decisions. But at least this contradiction is out in the open. That's not always the case. Later in the podcast, I'll be interviewing Kildare North Independent TD Catherine Murphy, talking about the SiteServe scandal. It's pretty clear what happened. Shareholders who had worthless shares in a bankrupt, insolvent company were paid 5 million euro for those shares when they weren't entitled to a cent. If that money was from a privately owned company, you could say, so what? If the company wants to throw away its money, so be it. But it wasn't their money. The money should have gone to the IBRC, what used to be Anglo-Irish Bank. We, the taxpayers, paid billions for this stinking carcass of a bank, and were entitled to whatever the assets can be sold for. But all the debts of Siteserve got forgiven. That's to say that more than 100 million euro that the taxpayer is owed will never be paid back. Dennis O'Brien got a profitable company on the cheap, when it seems that others were willing to pay more for it, and the shareholders, who should have lost everything, got a sweetener of 5 million euro. The fact that they all had the same law firm doesn't suggest that there was much commercial tension in the deal. It seems much more like old pals sorting each other out. Catherine Murphy is entitled to kudos for digging out this scandal. In this instance, it seems, we're finding out the truth, at least some of it, though I doubt we'll get our money back. But we shouldn't have to rely on the doggedness of a TD or on blind luck to try and keep on top of these scandals. For as long as modestly paid public servants have to make subjective decisions on issues that may benefit private individuals, we will have problems like this. It is inevitable that the benefit will sometimes circle around and influence the decision maker. Whether the benefit is a telephone or a telephone company, it's an incentive to bad governance. We need systemic change.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
And on the 28th of August, there was an article in The Independent about a congestion charge for Dublin, similar to in London. I'm joined on the line now by Brian Cook, the Deputy Director General of the Society of the Irish Motor Industry. Brian, what's the SIMI's attitude to congestion charging in Dublin?
Well, I think as it stands, if nothing else changed, I think you would say we will call it for what we see it as being, which is it's not a congestion charge. It's actually an anti-commuter tax. A congestion charge in isolation would be very unfair to the hard-pressed Irish commuter as things stand.
And what would you combine it with?
Well, I think as things stand at the moment, firstly, we need to evolve our public transport system into a more effective and a more inclusive way. The evidence is there. Look at the Dart. Look at the Lewis. If there is public transport available, people will use it. You know, they are packed from early in the morning to late in the evening. So people will use those services. But for a lot of people, the public transport system isn't in place as it is. I even know where I live. I actually live quite near a train station and I regularly use the train to commute. The park and ride facility is actually park and ride in a residential area, which is quite near two national schools. So even for people who live not too far out, there are safety issues there. But for people who live further out, particularly the younger people who bought their houses outside Dublin, they actually already have to drive into Dublin as it is, maybe to bring their kids into creche.
Well, surely, I'm sure you're right that there are many people who have to drive into the city. There are other people for whom that's discretional. And road space is an economic good. And it's an accepted tenet of economics that if you have a resource that is unpriced, it's going to be wasted. Isn't it likely that an awful lot of the road space that's being used in Dublin streets is actually wasted?
Well, I think you just see from the traffic flow that there are issues with traffic in Dublin. It doesn't move as well as it should.
But shouldn't people be able to say that I'm willing to pay for it? If people there are some people who are so marginal that they're not willing to pay for it, that wouldn't it be better to allow the people who need the road most to use it rather than congesting
everybody?
But I think
people, car owners and car commuters, they actually already are paying for it. I mean, the numbers are staggering. The amount of tax that is generated from the motorist is last year in excess of 5 billion, and this year will be in excess of 6 billion. So, I mean, they are already paying for it, and even in terms of usage, the more you drive, the more petrol you use, and the vast majority of the price of petrol or diesel actually goes to the government as a tax as it is.
Sure, but so, the more you drive, the more you pay in petrol. But if you drive on a motorway with very little traffic, you pay the same amount for your fuel as if you drive in very, very congested streets. Shouldn't that principle be extended so that people who use very, very intensely streets with a very high demand pay more?
Well, I think in isolation, no. And I think for the reasons I've already outlined, I think if congestion charges are to be brought in, it needs to be brought in as a basket of measures and not just as a blunt instrument to actually stop people going about their daily business. As well, there are people, I think you even mentioned it there, that some people have to actually drive in, mm-hmm. in and out of cities. There could be additional costs to them, additional costs of getting to and from work, and additional cost for their businesses as well. So, again, any additional tax is actually going to make Ireland a more expensive place.
Sure, there's a lot of people out there with cars who are marginal users of cars who don't need to drive every day. Wouldn't it be a good idea to incentivize them to say, well, you'll pay lower motor tax, and in return for lowering motor tax for everybody, the people who use the most congested roads pay for that, so you have a revenue-neutral system, but it rations the valuable road space more reasonably?
Yeah, but I suppose the debate at the moment appears to be focused on just bringing in a new charge. And if debate, as I think I indicated there, if it is a part of a wider basket of issues, that is something that could definitely be looked into in terms of improved public transport, in terms of incentives for people who have no choice but to drive in and out of the city. Some of that may be for business reasons or some of that may be for family reasons. So I think in isolation, the SIMI will be against a congestion charge. But as a basket of measures, it's something that could be looked at.
Sure.
If there is a quid pro quo, then I think that's something that the motorists might well be interested in.
Mm-hmm. One last point. Would you accept that the congestion itself is effectively a tax on motorists?
I would agree that congestion is a tax on motorists, but that is not just the motorist's fault. I think, as I indicated earlier, a lot of people live a long way outside the city and work in the city. The traffic flow in Dublin, in some cases, appears to be focused, while it is focused on actually getting public transport moving. At certain times, you see empty bus lanes and even empty trains at times, and yet the traffic still can't flow. So I think while I would agree that there is a cost there, I think to just blame the motorist, I actually think is a very simplistic way of looking at it. And I think a congestion charge is too simple a measure in isolation, and I think it needs to be looked at in a wider spectrum.
Brian Cook, Deputy Director General of SIMI, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, William.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Record a contribution to be included in the next show. Just dial 076-603-5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
On a Skype line now, I have Fergal Crehan, barrister at law. Fergal, you wrote about some of the controversies in legislating for the internet recently, particularly about online harassment and bullying. What do you think that the laws proposed by Lorraine Higgins and Pat Rabbit, what do you think of the merits of them?
Well, I'm mixed, I suppose, in my attitudes towards them. Pat Rabbit's bill proposes extending the old kind of nuisance telephone call legislation to cover nuisance communications online, which sounds like a logical thing when you view it in isolation, that obviously there were crank calls, threatening phone calls, you know, heavy breathers, all of this stuff. It didn't take long after the invention of the phone call for people to find ways to misuse it. Mm-hmm. And we criminalized those things. So it seems like simple common sense to extend them to cover internet communications. But I think where what makes this, in my opinion, a bad idea is that it forgets that internet communication is not the same kind of communication as a phone call. It doesn't have that intimacy, so that a threatening phone call is frightening and it's an intimate communication. Even a threatening email, a threatening letter is perhaps even more intimate because it contains the implied threat of we know where you live. Mm-hmm. And I suppose you can say perhaps a direct message on Twitter might share that intimacy, or a direct message on Facebook. But there seems to me a world of difference between someone sending a message to you and somebody speaking about you. No one would ever claim that making threats and sending someone poison pen letters was an expression of free speech. I mean, that is not an argument you'd be able to get off the ground. But if I speak very intemperately about a public figure online, and I'm speaking about them rather than to them or at them, certain free speech considerations do have to come into play that wouldn't be relevant when I was sending a message directly to a person.
So would it be, I think, with a public figure. Uh-huh. Would it be right then to say that you think the fact that by whatever medium, a message sent which is not aimed directly at its target but at a wider audience is diluted and therefore shouldn't be policed as strongly?
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say dilution. I mean, it's a message that is about somebody. We do not criminalize speech as a rule, unless the speech contains something more than speech. So, for example, if the speech is also an incitement to violence or to hatred, or if the speech is also a threat. You know, a threat is an action as well as simply a collection of words. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're talking publicly, you are engaging in some sort of public debate, and it can be extremely bad tempered public debate. You know, I have nothing but sympathy for Lorraine Higgins, who is the senator who was brought in, who has also brought in a bill. And I have nothing but sympathy for what she's had to put up with, particularly because I think women get far more abuse online than men do. And I think female politicians get more. But at the same time, when you're speaking about a person, we begin to curtail public debate when we say that speech must be respectful at all times. I would value the freedom to speak over the value of civility. And I think we should think very carefully before making kind of knee-jerk attempts to cover simple rudeness and incivility as a criminal offence.
One thing about that, clearly we're distinguishing between messages and perhaps threats sent to the person and just broader public discourse. Mm-hmm. But in, you know, you might get perhaps in a heated argument in a pub, in a pre-internet age, you might get somebody's political views or whatever being very robustly challenged. Mm-hmm. But when that's one person, that's one thing. But on the internet and perhaps on Twitter, that could be 1,000 messages, that could be 1,000,000 messages. And isn't there something that the internet is magnifying those type of messages, and just volume can be threatening?
Yeah, and I mean, there is, for example, a huge difficulty, and this is something that really only happens to people who are either in the public eye who through, you know, sometimes through no fault of their own, become in the public eye. And that can be very difficult because you don't necessarily have the same person making repeated threats. What you have is 1,000 people or 10,000 people all making similar threats. Now, I can understand how unpleasant and how frightening that must be, but it's purely from a pragmatic approach. If you're asking me how do we legislate for that, I don't know. Because you can't arrest a person for being one of 1,000 people.
That's true, but one, for example, in the Top Gear controversy, there was one particular female comedian who some people had suggested her as an alternative lead presenter for Top Gear. Before she was even aware that suggestion had been made, her Twitter feed was full of thousands of hateful messages, including many death threats.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a death threat is similar. A death threat is different if it is a credible threat, because death threats were always a crime long before the invention of the internet. But if it is simple abuse, I understand it has a harassing effect, that it's not necessarily persistent behavior by one person. But I don't know how we should deal with that. Is the short answer? Is the short answer I give you?
I want to move on to one other thing. We have mostly free rein amongst newspapers and on the internet as well. That if photographs are taken, they're generally owned by the person who takes that photograph, and there, you know, there are some provisions. I think you can perhaps speak more authoritatively on this than me, but there are some provision if photographs are taken surreptitiously. But it is in the nature of adolescents who are exploring their sexuality to take explicit photographs. Those have a habit of ending up online. Adolescent relationships tend to be much shorter than the adolescents expect. They tend to have a lot less experience and knowledge of the world to know that they should protect themselves from those type of photographs being taken in the first place. If somebody who may have been a boyfriend or girlfriend of whoever we will call the victim, if somebody takes a photograph, owns that photograph, publishes it online, as it stands in Ireland now, is that illegal?
It is not illegal in the sense that it isn't a criminal offence. And there is a criminal offence just recently introduced in the United Kingdom that would cover that, the publishing of intimate material without the person, the other person's consent. Now look, you know, we may get into arguments over what constitutes intimate, but I think that will cover most of those cases. There isn't a criminal offence in Ireland, but what there is the Data Protection Act, which, again, as you point out, for newspapers and media organisations, they don't really need to abide by that, because if you were forced to kind of respect the privacy of everybody's data, you could never report anything. Certainly, investigative journalism would become a thing of the past. But for the non-media outlet, you do own your own data, and that includes your phone number, but it also includes your address, and it includes any photographs taken or videos taken of you. So if somebody posts something online without your consent, you can demand that it be removed. And in cases where it's likely to cause you distress, you can demand that it be removed within 20 days. I would suggest and have suggested that 20-day period needs to be shortened, and there need to be consequences for internet services who don't respond within 20 days. But I think in principle, that is the remedy we have to this so-called revenge porn phenomenon.
Is an American porn website that's registered in the Bahamas and perhaps has servers in Hong Kong going to pay the blindest bit of attention to Irish laws?
None whatsoever, but the big ones are all in Ireland. And, you know, we can only deal with Ireland. We can never pass laws for what somebody in America or the Bahamas might do in terms of the internet or in terms of anything else.
I want to move on to one other thing. The European courts have introduced what is called a right to be forgotten. Just to clarify, this is not giving people a right to have negative news articles removed from the archives of newspapers. What it's giving people the right is to have the search results. So where perhaps you committed a crime, you were reported in the paper to have been convicted of that crime, that news report stays on the server of the newspaper, but Google and other search engines are being required to remove that particular page from their search indexes, so that if somebody Googles, for example, Fergal Crehan, then they can't very easily find that particular report. Is that a limitation on freedom of speech?
I don't think so, because Google aren't speaking. Google are just indexing what was out there already. And I mean, even the Google hate this. They hate it, and they've been trying to undermine it from the moment it happened. And they made some very intemperate and, in my view, very foolish remarks about book burning and censorship. You know, you have to remember Google are an advertising company, and they make their money by being able to index your information. So obviously Google are dead set against this. I think it's interesting that you talked about people who have perhaps embarrassing things about themselves or minor legal troubles that they wish to have forgotten. You know, the right applies to people who were the victims of crime as well, or perhaps somebody who gave evidence in the case, and they simply don't want. If I give evidence that puts somebody away to jail, that doesn't necessarily mean I want a court case to be the very first search result for my name. It doesn't mean I have anything to hide. It's just, you know, let's say I have an impressive CV. I've done other good things in my life. I have a LinkedIn profile that makes me look a desirable employee. I don't want a burglary or something to show up as the first result, even if I was the one responsible for obtaining the conviction.
That may be the case. But it seems like the people who are applying for this in Ireland are career criminals whose names are well known to at least to tabloid newspaper reporters.
What makes it seem like that, do you think?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm aware, and I don't want to name the people involved, but I'm aware that shall we say, prominent Dublin criminals are prominent on the list of people requesting this.
And how would, I'm trying to think through this, how would you become aware of that if Google hadn't told the world? Google aren't telling the world about the vast majority of entirely innocent people who are making the application.
That's a reasonable point. Nevertheless, does a career criminal have the right to have the references to their convictions removed from Google?
No, and they haven't.
Okay. And I know that Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia has come out very, very strongly against this. Is there a possibility that, for example, links on Wikipedia pages, and we all know how important the references on Wikipedia are, could they be required to remove historic references to people?
I think it's highly unlikely. The ruling applies to information which is inaccurate, irrelevant, out of date. There is a strong public interest exemption. So anyone who has a public profile, be he a career criminal or a politician, is not going to be able to avail of it.
Fergal Crehan, barrister at law and author and blogger at www.fergalcrehan.com. Thank you very much.
Not at all.
If you like the Here's How podcast, please rate and review the show on iTunes and other podcast providers. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Tell your friends. But most of all, make your views heard. Call us on 076-603-5060.
I'm joined on the line by Julian Despon, who is Ordrúni of Conan na Gaeilge. Julian, you wrote a piece for the Irish Examiner about the state's support for the Irish language. What are they doing wrong?
Well, there's a number of things they're doing wrong, and I suppose essentially the main point is that they need to, as a government, the state and the state apparatus need to get behind the Irish language, promotion of the Irish language, and providing services through Irish for Irish language speakers. And, you know, it's something that we've been sort of asking them to do for the last number of years. We've been, you know, and, you know, the government did publish a 20-year strategy for the language. They did publish a new Gaeltacht bill in 2012, but they haven't put any resources behind these two essential pieces of work that are meant to promote the language, are meant to, you know, provide more services, and they're meant to make sure that people who want the opportunity to use Irish, that they have that opportunity to use it.
Would you accept that obviously many millions, maybe billions, have been spent on promoting the Irish language since the foundation of the state? It's probably worth saying that the return on that investment has been poor.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, at the end of the day, if you think back to 100 years ago, there was only 600,000 people on the island who had Irish.
But all of them were native speakers.
Yes, they were, yeah. But now we have 2 million on the island of Ireland that have some level of Irish. So in certain respects, you know, there are more people who have an understanding, who have a level of Irish, but there's less native speakers. And that's one of the biggest things we need to address, is the danger to our Gaeltacht areas, to the native speakers in the Gaeltacht areas, that they aren't getting enough support. But when we talk about the billions that have been spent in the Irish language, you've got to take into account most of the people who refer to that figure are referring to the fact that it's taught in the schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those teachers would be employed anyway. So there's no saving to the state if Irish wasn't part of what they were teaching.
Sure, yeah, but if we weren't using that time to teach Irish, we could perhaps be teaching people German or Chinese.
Yeah, people also make that argument as well. But actually, if you find, and what international experts will tell you, that if you are learning a language in, say, primary level, and you go on to secondary level and you learn another language, actually, they're a benefit to each other. And the more language we learn, the better. I mean, Conan Gaeilge is very much behind the European ideal of mother tongue plus two. Mm-hmm. I think we're very bad at language learning in general in Ireland.
Isn't it a dangerous thread to be pulling on, that if we say learning Irish helps you learn another language, learning German or Chinese would help you learn another language as well?
Yeah, but I mean, you've also got to take into account that learning Irish is actually you would have more of supports as help in Ireland in learning Irish because it's all around us. It's part of who or what this country is. I mean, you only have to look at place names around the country to know that there's that's inherently I suppose part of the language learning is seeing it in practice, and you actually do see a bit of that in Ireland. So I actually think if you do that basically in primary school, when you get on to secondary school, I think they can benefit each other.
And they could, but in practice they don't seem to. Ireland, counting in the speaking of Irish, Ireland is one of the worst countries in Europe for just the total number of languages spoken on average. We speak an average of 1.6 languages each. There is almost no other country in Europe that has a figure less than two.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take it that the other probably country that is probably worse than us is the UK.
Yeah, Hungary is the worst, but then it's UK and us. Yeah,
but it is because English is probably the dominant language in the world, and that's the reason being behind it. I think people think that we have English, that's enough. It's not only just about job benefits, and there's a huge amount of jobs out there, be it for Irish, French, German, or other languages as well, but. It's also that, we know language learning people who are bilingual have cognitive reasoning benefits, that they have even going as far as Alzheimer's in the future, that actually does help. That if you're thinking in two languages, if you have two languages, it actually helps you fight that.
That's correct. I want to just move on to one other thing. And in your article, you adverted to a report from Ancorla Ishgas Gaeltacht Agus Gaelscoileachta. And one part of their report that you didn't mention was that amongst monolingual Irish speaking families, so that's to say core Gaeltacht speakers, first of all, in those families, a total of less than 1,000 children are being raised. So that's an extremely small number of people. And of those 1,000 kids, pretty much all of them, even though they're not their main language, their only language at home is Irish, but pretty much all of them speak better English than Irish. That's a terrible situation, isn't it?
Oh, it is, definitely. I mean, and I suppose that highlights the extreme, I suppose, place we are now at with Gaeltacht areas, and the support we need to make sure so that this is addressed.
And I want to take that into account.
In the past. And if you have to take into account that, as I say, English is the dominant language. In the education system, there's no curriculum that actually is based on or is geared towards Irish language speakers. So, for example, what they've done in second level, they've increased the amount of points that are available for the oral Irish, which is great in other schools. Mm-hmm. But in Gaeltacht areas, they've actually dumbed down the curriculum in essence. I mean, they've literally, if you were to do that in English, you were to take all Shakespeare and all the main writers off the course and say, well, it's more important that you can speak English. There'd be uproar.
Absolutely.
But what happened in the Gaeltacht areas?
Well, I want to address that point directly of having an Irish language strategy that is appropriate to the current situation. And one thing that I think alienates many people who are by nature, of course, English-speaking people who are by nature sympathetic to the Irish language, is the perception that a lot of the money that is earmarked for budgeted for promoting the Irish language actually ends up looking more like a community employment scheme to employ people who are Irish language speakers. And I'm thinking particularly about the Stodos campaign, getting Irish made into an official European language. That kind of sounds great. It sounds like a feather in our cap. But is it really sensible to be spending millions of euro translating a few minutes of MEPs' speeches and translating reams and reams of incredibly dull EU documents which nobody reads in English anyway? Is that a good use of Irish, of funds?
There's two things you raise there. The first is that if these things weren't done in Europe, the money wouldn't be made available to promote the language in any other way. That's a translation budget part of the EU, so there's no.
But aside from the budget, that's very alienating.
It's a translation budget that is being spent and we contribute to anyway. And, so why shouldn't Irish be part of that contribution? I haven't finished.
Go ahead and then I'll answer it.
Yeah. The second thing is that Irish was used more in the European Parliament more than Latvian, Estonian, And in one other language, I'm not sure, in 2013, we don't have the figures yet for 2014. So if people want to use Irish in the European Parliament, they should be able to use it. And Leonie Reader, for example, MEP from the South, only uses Irish in the European Parliament. So I think, you know, and one of the other things, factors that you have to take into account with the European Union is that they recognise the value of language. They recognise the value of difference in cultures, and they celebrate that.
Okay, let me go back and answer your question. And essentially what you're saying is, I'm not sure that you should be asking the questions, but that's a different point. essentially what it seems to me that you're saying is that this is in some way free money, or that it's not money being taken away from other Irish language resources. Therefore, why not spend it on translating incredibly obscure EU documents, or a couple of minutes? There are 750 MEPs. Leonie Reader isn't going to get that much said in Irish, and certainly not that much understood. But there's another reason, because it alienates people, and people feel that when there is perhaps a very small clique of very, very expert Irish speakers who insist on having these documents translated, that undermines the public support of people who are English speakers but would try Irish if they got a chance. It makes them feel alienated from the language. It makes them feel that it's maybe just a cash cow for a small clique of people, and it creates a bad feeling towards the language. Isn't that a good reason for not doing it?
No, I wouldn't agree at all. And it comes back to the other point that I made there, that, you know, it's the right of any, I suppose, MEP, if they wish to use Irish, that they would be able to do so. Also, you know, these documents that are being translated into all those different languages as well. And Irish should be part of that, because Irish.
Well, return then to the point, Julian. Return to the point that that we are dealing now with a generation of at most 1,000 kids who are growing up in Irish monolingual homes, and even they speak better English than Irish. Nobody is being disadvantaged by not having EU documents translated into Irish. Nobody is at any disadvantage at all.
The overall spectrum of things. And I think, you know, it's very disingenuous to say there's only 1,000, you know, children being brought from Gaelic areas. Therefore, you know, the rest of the people who have an interest in Irish are discounted. 80,000 people use Irish daily in their lives outside.
None of them are reading EU laws.
Outside of the educational system. Not only that, you know, there's 2 million people on the island of Ireland that have a level of Irish. And if you look at the amount of support that there's in the country, we did a Millward Brown survey at the start of the year, for example, that said 70% of the people of the public are behind services being made available to those who speak Irish if they so wish to use them in Irish. You know, so the public is overwhelmingly behind the language. If you were to do a very simple level, was in schools, we know the Gaelscoileanna movement has been fantastically successful. There's an oversubscription for the Gaelic schools, but how do we actually bring that into the other English medium schools? And one thing we'd say very simply would be that you could do other subjects through Irish.
Mm-hmm.
So be that something that the kids would enjoy, like art or PE or drama. And, you know, simple things like that could make a huge difference.
Absolutely. Wouldn't parents push for that more if they felt less excluded?
But I don't think, you know, and I don't think there's a case of people feeling less excluded. I think more and more it's that they don't get the opportunity. And one thing that you'll find, say for Seacht na Bhéaga, for an example, we find this, it's amazing in terms of participation and people feeling, this is the week that I'm going to use my Irish.
Julian Despon, Ordruni of Cumnall Gaeilge, thank you very much.
Make your view heard. Dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
I'm joined on the line now by Catherine Murphy, the TD for North Kildare, who uncovered much of the SiteServe scandal. Catherine, you're busy at the moment.
I am indeed, yes. By location is not something I've quite managed, and trying to find minutes to do things is, you know, is getting tough.
I can understand. Very briefly, do I understand what's going on here, that the SiteServe company was sold when it was absolutely insolvent, and despite that, €5 million of cash was given to the shareholders who essentially had worthless shares.
Yes, and it has been presented as though that the shareholders could have prevented this sale. I doubt that. If I was a shareholder with a company that had, you know, debts of in excess of €100 million over the value that it was sold for, I would have been in any rush to retain those debts on my back. And I don't see why, and I couldn't understand right from the word go, why, you know, there would have been a payout to the directors or the shareholders.
And your former party, the Labour Party, has, it seems, reneged on freedom of information commitments, whereby they said that they would undo the Fianna Fáil PD gutting of the Freedom of Information Act, imposing an awful lot of charges and restrictions on that. Labour Party said that they would undo that and restore the Freedom of Information Act. They don't seem to be doing that. What's your take on that?
First of all, it's a long time since I was in the Labour Party. I left in 2003, so let's just put that aside to begin with. But I think, you know, one of the democratic revolutions that needs to take place is transparency in how we do business in this country. I mean, I can understand that there can be commercial sensitivity in some things, but it's absolutely critical that we have an open approach to government if we're really to live in a proper democracy.
I understand. Specifically with SiteServe, it really seems that with the same legal team representing several different sides on the deal, we've got a problem whereby what is supposed to be run as a commercial company, the IBRC, the wound up Anglo-Irish Bank, is serving more than one master, that they have a commercial pressure on them, and they also have a political pressure on them, perhaps to keep sweet with their political masters. Do you think those two pressures can be combined successfully?
You've got to ask in a situation like that are decisions made in the interest of the bank, or are decisions made in the interest of the taxpayer, or the citizens of this state? In this particular case, where IBRC is an amalgam of Anglo and Irish Nationwide, it was set up to more or less deal with the distressed assets and wind it down in an orderly form, in an orderly way, to give the best return for the taxpayer. I think some of the questions that have been raised that very question you've posed to me. And I think the public will make their own decision on that. There can be only one master in those situations now. And even the fractious relationship that was very evident in the replies to Freedom of Information shows that it wasn't a department and IBRC working as a team, absolutely. But in actual fact, there was quite a bit of conflict between them, and I find that very, very hard to fathom.
Do you suspect that the people hanging over from the old Anglo days are just too friendly with the people like the shareholders of SiteServe, the former shareholders of SiteServe?
I wouldn't know all of the personnel involved. Clearly, I would know quite a lot because this is very complex, and myself and my staff in the office here have been working on this for some considerable time. But that is a value judgment that I'm just sticking to the facts at the moment.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I just want to broaden this out to is, I appreciate it's a long time since you were in the Labour Party, and it's an even longer time since you were in the Workers' Party, but there was back in the 80s, there was a theme of saying nationalise the banks, and we got that under circumstances that we never expected that to happen. But on a point of principle, is that a bad idea? Because it essentially sets up a conflict between the commercial pressures on any given bank and their pressures that come from politicians who are looking at constituents saying, this bank is charging me too much interest, this bank is repossessing my house and I don't want them to do that, so rather than going through court I can maybe get onto a politician and get them to put pressure on the bank. Can that circle ever be squared?
Look, I think the one thing that we know from all of what has happened, including the you know, around the time of the collapse and the kind of lending that has happened, the one thing that we absolutely need is proper regulation and oversight. That's one of the lessons we have had to we've had to learn in a very hard way.
Do you think that regulation can do better than nationalisation could?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between banks that are functioning as, you know, commercial entities in their own right without the involvement of the, you know, I mean, without the involvement of
as opposed to bankrupt banks.
You know, I mean, the IBRC is an entirely different type of entity. And, you know, indeed, you know, there is a hands-off approach. See, that's why these relationship frameworks are put in place between the department and the banks, so as that you can actually set out the rules and the ground rules. And, you know, there's no way that a politician should be able to go in and dictate, oh, you spend, you know, you've got to give a loan to this company because it's in my constituency or that kind of thing. That would be wholly inappropriate. So the conduct has got to be regulated. There's no two ways about that. But there is a clear difference in how some people are, you know, being treated, and other people are being treated. When you look at, I mean, I come across businesses all the time that are just absolutely, people are not even sleeping, worrying about debts. And, you know, here are other people in a position where they'll say, well, maybe we won't sell it unless we get, you know, a payout to shareholders. You know, you can understand why people would be upset by that.
I can. Catherine Murphy, Independent TD for Kildare North, thank you for joining me on the phone. I know you're very busy.
Make your view heard. Record your own contribution and email it to podcast@hereshow.ie. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
That's almost the end of episode 6 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 3rd of May 2015. References for everything that I mention in the show are listed in the page for this episode on the hereshow.ie website. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and write a nice review. Also, please like the show on Facebook. Please follow @hereshowpodcast on Twitter. And, of course, subscribe to the show. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. You can do all of that right from www.hereshow.ie. Or you could just go out and meet your friends and tell them how great the podcast is. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.